Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right. You're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to Legal Face-Off with Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini. I'm David Jennings. I'm sort of your kind of host, kind of moderator, but we'll see how this all shakes out. Let's jump right in. Daily Show to, well, the Legal Show. I will leave it to Rich to explain.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. It's a really interesting journey. You're an accomplished actor and journalist with many credits, including, as we've just discussed, off-air, The Daily Show. Tell us how you transitioned from that platform to a law firm where you're currently employed.
Well, during the whole, I started off out of school as a TV journalist, right? Then I quit TV news to pursue comedy and acting, landed on The Daily Show and other credits. And the joke about comedy, which is very true, Rich, is it is largely unemployment interrupted by work. So you have to, you know, have a side gig at all times. And one of my side gigs was consulting corporations on public speaking and media training. So I kept that going through the years. As I've gotten older and life has taken us down different roads with children, I have retired from acting. And so now I'm in a position where I'm like, okay, I'm still alive. I have some years still in front of me. What do I do? And so professionally, what I've segued into is a lot of public relations work. And long story short, one of the openings that intrigued me came from the law firm that I now work for, Edelson PC. So that's why I'm here.
So, Bob, you do have a role, obviously, at the Edelson firm. We've had Jay Edelson on our show before. There's something very unique that the Edelson law firm is doing that you're going to be at the hub of, which is Edelson Creative. Can you explain to our listeners a little bit more about what that's all about?
Yeah, Edelson Creative is kind of serves two purposes for the firm. One, it's a creative outlet just for our people to explore and be creative, which I think is a really healthy thing for a law firm or any company to do of size. And two, it allows us to get our voice out. We're Edelson, as you may know, is a big advocate for reform and what's going on in the plaintiff's bar and class action lawsuits. And that Edelson Creative outlet allows us to make some social commentary about what's wrong right now through some entertaining pieces. So we have a partner that's an excellent rap MC. So we've got rap videos on there that if you listen to the words, it's all about what's wrong with the plaintiff's bar. So that's why it's there. It's a vehicle for us to get our voice out in the world in our own unique way.
Bob, I actually have gone the opposite way. I've been a lawyer for many years and work at a law firm. I recently tried my hand at stand-up. So we're crossing each other professionally. I'm sure you still have your hand in stand-up. But yeah, it's something I've always wanted to try. And, you know, my logic was I talk to juries all the time. I speak on my feet to a lot of conferences. You know, I found myself telling kind of the same one or two or three stories that I found was pretty funny to these groups. And I got a reaction. So I literally thought, you know, it's not that big of a transition. Stupidly, of course, it's the biggest transition. But what have you taken from your prior life in stand-up and writing and as a journalist that has helped you in your current position the most?
I think the two things that really helped me is storytelling. A kind of a universal theme for all my my work has been the value of good storytelling. And also, especially in today's online world, it's being authentic. And any good stand-up is being true to their voice. And when they establish who they are, then the audience gets to ride along with them. So those two things resonate with me. Some of my biggest, that I'm the biggest fan of in stand-up right now, don't tell necessarily punchline, you know, joke. They tell stories on the stage that are funny and entertaining and take you on a ride. So those two skills really apply themselves to what I do now, too.
So, Bob, you did a TED Talk and you also have a book discussing how to take the BS out of business talk. Can you give us some examples?
Well, let's see. Boondoggle. is one. Scalable is another. The example I give to people, what is business speak or BS, as I call in the book, and it could mean, you know, the other BS meaning, is at home, I'm the father of some children. I'm likely to turn to one of my kids and say, hey, son, are you ready to go? While at work, using the language of BS, I'm much more likely to say, is it scalable for you to give me an ETA on departure? You know, I need to know ASAP, right? That's an example of BS. And what I'm railing against in the book and with the TED Talk is just identifying that this is becoming more and more prevalent in society for whatever reason. And there are pitfalls, and I detail that in the TED Talk. The book itself is a collection of roughly 300 words and phrases that are commonly used in business and outside of business. Gives you the origin story, the true definition, and then a joke. Because of my background, hopefully telling you what boondoggle means or it is what it is when somebody says that in the workplace.
You know, Bob, at the end of the day,
nice.
Probably saying, I can't hear that enough. And I read some of this material that you produce, and it's incredible. And Tina and I, thanks, for, you know, almost 10 years now have been on this podcast. And one of the most common subjects is this idea that lawyers need, they have this inherent need to sound like they're lawyers, right?
Yes.
No one thinks that you're going to be believed as a lawyer if you don't use terms like heretofore and herewith and
yes,
PC attachment. It's crazy. And,
yeah,
you know, especially with younger lawyers, it's really hard to get them out of that habit that they come out of law school with, that they think that, you know, you got to sound like a lawyer. And just the opposite is true. I think any judge, any experienced client will tell you that they want the opposite. They want, you know, yeah, information that's high quality. Make no mistake about it. It's got to be high quality. Mm-hmm. They want it quick. They want it easy to digest. I mean, that's just the nature of our society. So it's a challenge to get over this BS that you talk about. So I'm so glad that you're addressing it, because it really is such a prevailing problem these days in what we all do, I think.
Yeah, I think you hit it right on the head, Rich. And I think, you know, you talked about, I think maybe before we came on camera here, about your experience of talking in front of juries, right? And that experience kind of led to your interest in stand-up comedy. And the idea is, if you're going to convince a jury of your peers, you're not going to convince them with the fancy words. You're going to convince them by telling good stories that are relatable, that use words that we all use and can quickly understand. And I think it is common. It's also common among doctors, bedside manner with doctors. You'll get young doctors, especially, that will use words that as a patient, you're like, I don't know if that means I have cancer or not. You know, those type of moments. It doesn't mean dumbing down. It just means bring people together with your language rather than keeping us apart.
Bob, you were the official nationwide spokesperson for over 2 years. So this brings us over to the topic of learning jingles. So what's that journey, the jingle learning process? What does that look like?
Yeah, we picture
it is much more involved than I ever thought it would be, Tina. When I took that job, I'm not a singer. This was not part of the audition process, was to sing their jingle. But as the role evolved, they realized how valuable that jingle was. And in my character, they wanted me to sing the jingle a lot. Well, I thought I was singing the jingle correctly, but I would routinely get notes from the production crew when I'm cutting into a microphone of like, Bob, that was good. Can you just, you need to go up on the nationwide. You know, nationwide is on your side. It was just like, are you kidding me? I don't hear these nuances that you're hearing. But I eventually became, I guess I could put that on a resume now as a skill, Tina, that I can sing professionally.
And I would imagine that it's probably become one of the biggest earworms that you've ever encountered. Like once you've done it over and over and over again, you're probably never going to be able to get rid of it, right?
Yeah, totally. I remember telling the people at Nationwide, really the most effective part of almost any insurance company's advertising is their jingles. Just put up the jingle for like 10 seconds. And I don't know if you've followed this on TikTok or other social media. Now there's been a people singing the Nationwide jingle in elaborate, you know, multi-chorused ways. It's a thing now to sing it really well. Earworm totally describes it.
Our thanks to Bob Wiltfong on his journey from where he was on camera to where he is now, where he's helping other people speak English to each other, which can be challenging on occasion.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and Leading Lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
You may remember a few weeks ago seeing on television a commercial. It involved Governor Kristi Noem of South Dakota, and she was talking about a trip to Texas to fix up her teeth and make them look right. What was really going on there? Christina Martini's got a guest who may have some insights.
So, Professor Richard Ford, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
So what we're going to talk about today is what I think has become part of our political dialogue pretty recently, which is the whole idea of Trumpification. So what does that term mean, particularly in the context of our political dialogue as we are approaching the presidential election?
Well, I think a lot of people have observed that many of the people who work with Donald Trump, particularly women, have a similar personal style, and that that personal style seems to be the style that is favored by Donald Trump. He once said something like, "I like women to dress like women." And so there's a certain kind of highly polished and some might even say dolled up look that many of the women on his legal team and other women working with him seem to conform to.
As you heard, Professor, in the intro, this applies now to Kristi Noem, the South Dakota governor, who has undergone a rather dramatic makeover. I saw pictures of her before this makeover, and she looked nothing like the way she looks now. Many are considering this makeover inappropriate. I mean, number one, the advertisement for this dental clinic inappropriate for a sitting governor. But also, many consider this her tryout to be Trump's running mate. Last week, Trump said, I think the words were, "I'm not going to call her beautiful because I can't do that these days, but she's beautiful." So Trump has a long history, of course, of emphasizing and valuing people's looks above many other characteristics. Is that what's going on here? And how do you think the governor is a perhaps victim of Trumpification or purveyor of it, or however you want to call it?
Yes, well, it does appear that she has somewhat dramatically transformed her personal look to come closer to the kind of look that is associated with Donald Trump and the women that he surrounds himself with. And, I would say that if a woman truly for her own purposes and her own sense of style likes that look, that's great. There's nothing wrong with it. I think the thing that is troubling to a lot of people is that that doesn't seem to be the case, that, she had a personal look that she had been successful with, seemed comfortable with before, and that she's moved in a direction that, you might describe as objectifying, in order to audition in some sense for the running mate position.
So, Professor, people are couching this particularly when we're talking about, for example, Governor Noem, as political image making, which is something that isn't a new concept. The conservatives have had various women who have sort of become known for this, including Phyllis Schlafly, who was the leader of the anti-ERA movement, as well as Sarah Palin. So when you throw those names into the same bucket as Governor Noem, ultimately, what are they trying to accomplish with these efforts? And would you say that they're successful in these efforts?
Oh, well, yes. I mean, you're absolutely right to mention that this is not new. There's something that's perhaps more pronounced about it with respect to Donald Trump, but it's got a long history. And the contention or irony there is that you have women who were very powerful women, very successful women, but who have gotten powerful and successful in part by pushing against the grain of conventional feminism. And some of what they seem to be conveying is that I am a traditional woman. I'm a woman who accepts the traditional woman's role, which includes in our society the accepting the idea that women are valued for their looks, that they are in some sense required to be decorative in a way that men certainly are not. And I think that does signal to some extent a willingness to be submissive to male authority.
Do you think, Bill, that this is something that resonates with a lot of the voters? This whole notion, I mean, it is a really sort of delicate dance here between trying to convey someone who's qualified for the role, particularly if for some reason, you know, the president becomes incapacitated and they have to step into the role, but also this more traditional role of women. I mean, it seems to be a pretty delicate balance.
Oh, absolutely. I think that it's really almost a catch-22 for professional women, which is one of the reasons that so many people are concerned about it, because it's very difficult for a woman to both convey authority and strength, and at the same time convey this kind of conventional decorative feminine affect. Some women can pull it off, but it's not easy. And so, for instance, if you think about the reaction to the response to President Biden's State of the Union speech, there, a lot of people thought that she didn't carry it off. So it's hard for women to do this. I do think it's appealing to a certain segment of voters. And so they're not wrong to imagine that this is something that might further their career or even that they need to do in order to be taken seriously for a position in, for instance, the Trump administration. But it is a catch-22.
Professor, last question here on Legal Face-Off. Again, your excellent book is Dress Codes, How the Laws of Fashion Made History. We see this issue around us every day, right? Not just with the South Dakota governor, but, you know, for example, you just mentioned the State of the Union. Who is the most prominent, one of the most prominent people of the State of the Union? Marjorie Taylor Greene. Why? Because she was dressed, in my opinion, like a clown, right? She was dressed all in red. She was wearing the MAGA outfit. She stood out, right? She did so quite purposely. Katie Britz, right? The Alabama senator. She gave the response to the State of the Union. And among the many reasons people maligned her, quite appropriately, in my opinion, was the way she presented, the way she was in her kitchen, the way she dressed like a homemaker, right? We see Sam Bankman-Fried. We're covering that story here in a moment. He was sentenced yesterday to 25 years in prison. Much was made over the way he testified and, you know, the way he looked, quite frankly. I mean, his hair was, you know, a little bit less disheveled than normal, but he, you know, didn't appear great. And that's a lot of what influenced the jurors, it appears. So how important do dress codes continue to be, even though in today's society, especially post-COVID, we're living in a much more relaxed dress code society, given that, you know, people are showing up at work in sweatpants and dress casual and all that. Long-winded question, I'm sorry, but, you know, it's very interesting that your book is as relevant today as it ever was.
Yes, it's a great question. I'd argue that dress codes are as important as ever, and in some sense, perhaps even more important. So, because on the one hand, before we had more formality and therefore more uniformity in the way people dress. You think about politics, the typical politician, you know, they all dressed in a pretty conventional, boring fashion. That was the homework assignment if you were a politician. Now, with standards of formality becoming more relaxed, there's a sense in which everyone's mode of dress is a reflection on their true self, or at least that's what we tend to think, that they're making a brand statement. So the branding through dress has become more pronounced as the uniformity has become less required. And in that sense, the message that one sends through their clothing is more important than ever. You know, Marjorie Taylor Greene's a great example. She's sending precisely the message that she wants to send to her constituency through that clothing. And we saw the same thing with Katie Britt and the kitchen table, that there is a message being sent. I'm a conventional woman. I'm, you know, a proponent of conventional femininity. That's now part of the job of being a politician.
Our thanks to you, Professor Richard Thompson Ford.
Thank you.
The New York State Legislature has got some work to do. The problem is squatters. Christina Martini takes the lead.
Thank you so much, Assemblyman Jake Blumenkranz from New York, for joining us today to have our conversation on the squatter situation.
Good. How are you guys doing today?
Good. So thank you for joining us. So we've all been hearing in recent months about the growing squatter problem across the country, including in New York. Can you just, for our listeners, give us at least some of the reasons why we're seeing this uptick in the squatter problem?
Sure. Unfortunately, I believe the issue is multifactorial, right? We have a housing crisis, we have a cost of living crisis, we have a rising amount of new residents, especially vis-a-vis the migrant issue and crisis that we're facing in New York especially. So a lot of these factors together create a precarious situation, especially for those seeking housing.
Can you explain, Assemblyman, some of those laws and why they're at least perceived to be very tenant-friendly?
Yeah, sure. So there are many pieces of legislation. New York is always first in the nation when it comes to tenant protections, right? So you have the HSTPA. You have right now they're trying to fight for good cause eviction. They're always trying to make the hurdle and the bar higher when it comes to protecting tenants and stopping evictions. So we've seen sort of an overcorrection, especially in some of these instances where we've seen some malfeasance or bad actors in these cases. And that's the trouble we're looking to fix here.
And just for those of us, perhaps our listeners who aren't very familiar with, you know, New York and the cost of living, the origins of those kind of laws are because it is one of the more expensive cities in the world to live in. And some of the malfeasance that you're referring to is landlords over the years increasing rents and, you know, not being maybe the best stewards of their property. Is that correct?
Yes, that's the original intent of the bills. I think we could talk all day long as to why, you know, we think that they may be good or bad the way that they've been implemented. But that's a different conversation for a different podcast.
So, Assemblyman, you mentioned that these laws have overcorrected. And you've also spoken about how there are some loopholes in these laws, and you've proposed some new legislation that would make it easier for a homeowner to remove a squatter from their property. Why don't you tell us more about your bill and where it currently stands and what you're really trying to focus on by way of the loopholes, for example?
Sure. Thanks. So I've introduced the Property Protection Act to close this loophole and to protect homeowners and protect property owners who are facing sometimes very unjust situations. I'll give a case right now of Miss Emmett, who was recently on the news with myself. She had put her keys in the mailbox. So her previous tenant had gone to the grocery store. Then a bad actor came to the house. He painted his name on the mailbox. And then when she tried to get him out, she had someone who broke into her home. The police said, you know, we can't do anything. This seems like a tenant dispute, and had to walk away. She did not have access to her unit for 3 years. It's unfair. It's unjust. And frankly, to me, it's un-American. All my bill does is if the police show up at one of these scenarios, that tenant must show title, right, or permission from the rightful owner, as well as payment of rent. So if they can show one, two, three of those things, they'll go to housing court still. They'll be able to fight for that dispute. But in many of these cases, they're showing, you know, not enough evidence that you and I would say, all right, there's just cause here. So, and there also is a change in, they'd have to show intent that they're squatting. So if there's intent there, a judge will be able to see that and throw them out, because we'll make it criminal trespassing instead of tenancy.
Assemblyman, you mentioned that you can't discuss this issue without discussing the inevitable relationship between squatters and the migrant crisis. We saw the video that went viral. We'll be discussing that shortly in our grab bag of this, TikToker who was encouraging people to squat and to take over homes. We also see a crisis on the streets of New York City, what appears to be random punching episodes of women being, you know, struck literally in the face by random people. We don't know if they're, you know, migrants or not. Some of them appear to be, you know, homeless. But this seems to be a crisis that's happening not just in New York, although these are prominent examples. The first example, I think, is the TikToker might be in Columbus, Ohio, or so forth. But how do you see all of this intertwined with the problem that you're dealing with?
I think we're seeing a catalyst here that'll make this problem even worse. That is why I think this legislation is so important right now. We've gotten a bipartisan coalition because people see that this will only get worse, considering some of the reforms we've made to the criminal justice system, as well as the rising amount of New Yorkers that are entering the city every single day without housing, right? And now the city's right to housing, the city has to house them, and it becomes a very precarious situation for everyone. So closing this loophole, I think, is just one step we can take to fixing some of those issues.
Assemblyman, it seems like you've gotten quite a bit of support on this bill, but there's also, as with everything, some opposition. Why don't you tell us a bit about the folks that are opposing this bill?
Sure. So we have had a lot of support in our house. We have almost 50 members out of 150 assembly members, which is fantastic. It's bipartisan. There are members from anywhere from the city to upstate to Long Island. And it's really great to see. But there is and always will be tenant advocates who see any change to the law as an affront on them and their rights. This bill will not do this. This bill will not remove tenancy court. It simply removes the bad actors who are causing good, hardworking people who work their whole life to purchase a home or to purchase a second unit so they can retire peacefully in New York, the ability to seek justice in a timely manner.
Out of curiosity, whatever happened to common sense in the application of the law?
That's a fantastic question. Unfortunately, some of the reforms created over the past few decades have been painting with such a broad brush that it ties the hands of judges to have discretion in these case by case. It ties the hands of police to resolve matters that are so obviously fraud. And we've gone from having tenant protections to scammer protections in some of these cases. And we're simply removing that aspect of the law.
Thank you, Assemblyman. Assemblyman Jake Blumenkrantz of the New York State Legislature, who's trying to do something about stopping people from squatting and becoming illegal, and I guess in a way, tenants in someone else's property. It's a headache that is really hitting the state of New York right now. Thank you, Assemblyman.
Thank you so much. Thank you guys for having me.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crane Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Next story on Legal Faceoff, very much in the news, the Baltimore bridge collapse. We've got Maryland plaintiff's attorney, one of the best in the state, personal injury plaintiff's lawyer, Paul Beckman from Beckman, Martyr, Hopper, Malarkey, and Perlin. He's the founder of that firm, and we're very privileged to have him on the show. Paul, welcome.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing good. So this Baltimore bridge accident is obviously going to go down to be one of the largest marine losses in history. Who do you think may be liable?
Well, there is a lot of question about who may be liable. Is the ship liable? Was there something wrong that may have been known and not detected? Were there ways to have avoided the collision? There were pilots aboard. And a lot of this is just going to come to bear as time passes on. But Rich, I think one of the most important things for people to know about this horrendous event is what law applies. And you say to yourself, well, the people who were injured and or killed appear to have been on the bridge, and the bridge is not on the water. Does Maryland law apply? Or does the maritime law apply? And the answer is very clear. The maritime law applies. In 1948, not quite 80 years ago, Congress passed a law called the Admiralty Extension Act. And it provides that if a vessel is on navigable waters and causes damage on the shore, including a bridge, the maritime law will apply. And the reason that that is extremely important here is because the maritime law has concepts that are different than the land-based law, one of which is that a ship owner can limit its liability to the value of the vessel after the casualty, including pending freight. Now, this vessel was a gigantic vessel. It was carrying a tremendous load of cargo. The containers were stacked seven high all over the vessel. It's almost 1,000 feet long. And at the very least, there was at least 95,000 tons of cargo plus the vessel itself. So you can imagine what that would be. And you can also imagine about the claims that would be filed. Not only will there be injury and death claims filed, but there will be claims filed for the damage to the bridge, the repair of the bridge, the interruption of traffic, the delay in transferring some of the goods from the vessel to other ports, and on and on and on. So limitation of liability is the concept that changes the whole equation. If the ship owner can provide information that it was without knowledge or what's called privity of a dangerous condition, they can limit their liability to the value of the vessel and the freight pending. So what happens if you look at this and you have see all of these claims that are going to be filed? How can these people who were injured and or were killed get anything? Well, one of the things that does exist here, which again is one of the natures of this act, is that a special fund will be set up to include everyone who's injured or killed or their surviving relatives or beneficiaries if there is inadequate amount of money available to pay for their claims. And the fund is increased, and get this, by $420 a gross ton. So you can imagine what that could be depending on the size and the freight that's pending. So this is something, Rich, that's going to go on for some time. It can be a very technical matter. I've been involved in these cases for a long time. I've tried several of them, and they all go to federal court. They are tried non-jury. There is no jury that tries these. They're handled by federal judge. And it will be a tremendous number of people that are going to be involved.
Paul, having had these kind of cases before, represented victims of similar issues or similar accidents, how important is the initial investigation? Obviously, it's very complicated in this case, given all of what we're seeing on TV, right? The amount of bridge that's literally on the hull of the ship, the fact that the water is so murky, they haven't even been able to find all of the bodies, the car is submerged. That is obviously adding to the difficulty of figuring out what happened. And, you know, talking about the inevitable litigation that's going to come from it, it's really important to get on site very quickly, preserve evidence. Otherwise, it could be gone forever.
And you're absolutely right, Rich. And what's happened here are a couple of things. First, the National Transportation Safety Board got on board right away. They brought their investigators on. They talked to everybody in the crew. There were two pilots on board at the time. They have been able to do recreations of how fast the vessel was going. And for example, whether in fact the incident could have been avoided by dropping anchors and moving just a little bit to the left, and this would never have happened. So there are all kinds of issues that are going to arise relating to A, was this preventable? B, how successful would it have been? C, was there something wrong with this vessel that existed before this incident took place? And I'm sure people have read about the fact that there was an incident in 2016 with this vessel when it ran into something. And there was also some issues related, reported about the oil protection aboard the vessel and the mechanisms that power the ship. So there, you are absolutely right. There's going to be a tremendous investigation. The Coast Guard may also get involved, but the NTSB, National Transportation Safety Board, may very well have hearings relating to the accumulation of this evidence. We, as lawyers, can't get on there right now because it is in the hands of the United States government.
Paul, do you see any criminal exposure for anyone here, and how might that play into the civil case?
Well, from all that we can tell, Rich, there does not appear to be any kind of outside activity where you have individuals trying to sabotage the vessel. That I don't think exists. As far as criminal activity, I don't believe that there's going to be any, but there may very well be civil liability. We know that for a fact. And until the facts develop, until we can get detailed information, and as you know, in any kind of litigation, particularly one like this catastrophe, there are all kinds of things that take place. Depositions, discovery, production of documents, inspections. All of that is going to take place, I'm sure, for quite some time.
Paul, last question here on Legal Face Up. We really appreciate you being on. You're, again, a skilled plaintiff's lawyer. You talk to juries for a living. We talked earlier today, in fact, about the need to tell a story to a jury, right? In the last just few weeks, we've seen high-profile incidents of transportation going wrong. We saw derailment in Pennsylvania. We've, of course, seen very high-profile examples of airplanes, you know, with things dropping off them, doors, wheels, that resulted in the Boeing CEO literally resigning a few days ago. We see this story. How would that all weave into the story you would tell a jury if you were representing someone in this Baltimore Bridge collapse?
Well, what I would want to know, Rich, are what are the facts that we can prove? How do we convert the complex to the simple? And that's the job of a trial lawyer who does this work. And right at this moment, there just is not enough data for us to tell that story, but I can guarantee you that it will be told.
Do you see a theme here of, you know, maybe the public trust in transportation, you know, being eroded given all these high profile incidents, and might make your job easier, given that this seems to be a trend these days, at least in the last few weeks, of trains and this vessel and airplanes having, you know, pretty dramatic things go wrong with them?
Well, it's true. And of course, this is local. This is a bridge that had 35,000 people go over it a day. It's been there since 1977. It leads right into the port. So this is hometown. And the where this case is going to be filed is going to be in the U.S. District Court for the District of Maryland in Baltimore. So everybody's going to know about it.
Tragic case. We'll be following. We'd love to have you back. Paul Beckman from Beckman, Martyr, Hopper, Malarkey, and Perlin. The website is mdtrialfirm.com. Thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Thanks for asking me, Rich.
Now it's time for the Legal Grab Bag on Legal Face-Off. We're joined by attorney Jordan Rothman of Rothman Law LLC and Jason Reichel of TrustLayer.
Not much time, Tina. Let's roll through. And we start off every Legal Grab Bag with, of course, Trump Watch, because the former president provides us with so much legal content. The too many stories since our last show to cover, but the one that really jumped out at me was, you know, the day that Trump is slapped with yet another gag order, in this one in the New York hush money case. What does he do? Does he follow the gag order? Of course not. He goes out and criticizes the daughter of the judge a day after he was hit with that gag order. The judge is named Juan Merchan. He accused the judge of being of issuing a legal, un-American, unconstitutional gag order. That's what he put out on Truth Social. And then he also criticized his daughter, like I mentioned, saying his daughter had a role in a firm that works for various Democrats, including Joe Biden. So I don't think that technically attacking the judge's daughter is a violation of the gag order, Tina, but not that smart, you know, not the smartest thing. Although, on the other hand, it might be the smartest move that Trump does, consistent with his strategy of being an agitator, right? I mean, this is nothing new. Trump loves to be the victim. It's raising a ton of money for him. And by all accounts, all of these legal cases against him, including the one that generated this gag order, have had no effect on the race, on his popularity. By the latest poll, he's leading Joe Biden by a wider margin than ever. So maybe he's playing this all the right way. Who knows?
Yeah, Rich, I mean, I think you've hit the nail on the head that, you know, as outrageous as a lot of what we talk about from show to show on in our Trump Watch and the Grab Bag, as outrageous as much of this is, when you sort of take the step back and look at it from a 50,000 foot perspective, you know, some would say it's genius in terms of his sort of laser focus on the end goal, which is to try to get himself elected again as president. And, you know, taking it right to the line in terms of pleading his case about why he's being unjustly treated, because it feeds into his popularity, as you said. And it also feeds into what he's trying to do, for example, from a merchandising perspective, which we're going to get into a little bit later. But people feel badly for him. And so it helps feed, you know, his popularity as well as the financial support.
Yeah, 100%. Jordan, I've got a case on Monday in front of a judge here in Cook County that's notorious for tearing people apart if they're not prepared. So I'm going to be, you know, dreaming all weekend of this case, making sure I'm well prepared. I would never think to look at this particular judge the wrong way, let alone criticize the judge's daughter. But of course, I'm not Trump, and Trump can get away with things that normal human beings can't.
Sure, that's true. And this is a common behavior of Trump. Obviously, with other judges that have been involved with other cases, he's gone after court officers. For instance, you know, in the case in front of Judge Engoron in New York about the civil fraud case, I know that there's been a lot of talk about court officers by Trump. And it's unfortunate because it hurts the judicial process. And I wonder what the impact will be in the judicial process. I completely understand that this could be good for his election goals. I don't know how good this is going to be for his legal troubles and what the impact might be for jurors and the judges who are going to decide his fate.
I'm just curious. Would any other defendant in the exact same setting be allowed the excesses that we have seen allowed by courts that have been dealing with the former president of the United States?
No, definitely not. I mean, in some ways, they treat Jordan and Tina, they treat Trump like courts treat pro se litigants, right? If you've ever had a case with a pro se litigant, you would think that the judges would be very strict with them. The opposite is true. They bend over backwards to avoid being accused of taking advantage of someone who doesn't know the legal system. In many ways, Trump, even though he employs some of the most expensive and, you know, presumably experienced lawyers in the nation, is a pro se litigant. And judges, instead of clamping down on his behavior, they have bent over backwards in many ways. Now, sometimes that's not the case, as we've seen in the record, you know, some in the case that was just handed down, then, you know, lowered by the appellate court. But yeah, I mean, no one else would get away with this, but maybe he should be given more leeway because he is the ex-president after all. So maybe there is something of that. But yeah, for sure, this is all unprecedented. It's stuff we've never seen before. Jason, what's your take on this? And also the fact that, like I said, in the case where he was convicted of fraud, that amount was reduced substantially. Still a huge amount. I think it's now $150 million.
Yeah.
But what's your thoughts on the latest in Trump?
Well, I just go, this is just in the transformation from that persona of businessman to victim to underdog that he is, I think, masterfully playing across our systems. A lot of times when I look at this, it's all based on like everyone has a fear of court. So if he can show, you know, that he's sticking it to the systems, that's really good for his underdog status and for him to repair essentially what he lost the first time around, which is he's this great businessman. Now he's the person who defies systems. And I think that's really good for, again, like you guys said, for his election bid. Don't know how good it is for his court, but I mean, isn't all of this, if he gets into office again, he can just forgive himself of all of this? Isn't that, I mean, what's the longer play there? Like, does this have ramifications if he does get reelected, or does this go all down the drain once if he does get reelected? You know, that's where I'm at on this.
Sam Bankman-Fried heard what he didn't want to hear from a federal judge. 25 years in prison for the FTX scandal.
Yeah, since yesterday, you know, not a real surprise, I think, by anyone who followed this trial closely, Jordan. By all accounts, he did not do well. That was very impactful to everyone. The judge remarked that not only did he not show remorse, but he lied, basically, when he testified. And of course, that's one of the perils of any defendant testifying. That's why over and over again in high profile cases, we frequently discuss whether a defendant is going to testify. And this is one good reason why probably he shouldn't have, because, again, he wasn't very credible, wasn't sympathetic, showed very little remorse, even though he released a statement that said, "It haunts me every day." He didn't really take responsibility, you know? And I think that weighed heavily on the judge here. And again, it's not that surprising given what others who have been similarly convicted have received. You know, Elizabeth Holmes received 11 years. Madoff received 150 years. Of course, SBF is called Mini Madoff. He died before he served much of that sentence, of course. Others, let's see, Jeff Skilling of Enron received 24 years. The former CEO of WorldCom, Bernie Ebbers, received 25 years. So right along the lines of that. And again, the other reason it's not very surprising, even though he argued that this was a victimless crime, we heard from actual victims, right? We heard victim statements, both oral and written, where actual victims whose fortunes dried up as a result of this fraud testified how it's impacted their lives. These are real people, not some abstract, you know, crypto concept. These are actual people who said, you know, their life savings have been dissipated. They have to look in their kids' eyes and tell them this, that, you know, their spouses are near suicide. They put off marriages, all the things that you would, you know, understand would go along with losing considerable amounts of money the judge heard from. So probably, you know, the right sentence and along the lines of what others have received.
Yeah, I agree. I think the sentence was right in the ballpark of what was to be expected. The interesting thing that I was wondering going into the sentencing was, would Judge Kaplan consider the fact that all the victims of the FTX fraud be made whole, given the fact they might be made whole? Would that have an influence on sentencing? And it seems like it didn't. And I understand why, because even if the victims are made whole, they were without this money for years, which could have had a very material impact on their lives. So that was the only question that I had. But ultimately, I think Judge Kaplan did the right thing. And it's interesting to think that, you know, SBF is in his early 30s. I guess he'll be in his early 50s when he gets out. So he'll probably have another chapter in his life after he's released from prison.
Yeah. And that's one of the things the judge said, is that there's some danger of this happening again, given how old he is and given, you know, how fraudulent his behavior was. So, you know, stay tuned and perhaps we'll be seeing more from him sometime in the near future. Hopefully not, though.
Moving right along to our next item, Sean Diddy Combs. It's going to get interesting for him. Gentlemen and ladies, take it away.
So earlier this week, Homeland Security investigation officials swept through rapper Sean Combs' Los Angeles and Miami properties in an effort to collect evidence in what has been called an ongoing investigation. His lawyers claim that excessive force was used during these raids, directed at both his employees as well as his kids, who were photographed as being handcuffed outside of his LA mansion. Diddy was also apparently spotted this week with some family members at the Miami Executive Airport as all of this was going on, and was stopped by federal agents who apparently took a number of electronic devices from him, but did not detain him or his family. Diddy's lawyer says that a lot of people are rushing to judge Combs on what these enforcement actions are all about. And Homeland Security authorities, understandably, have not disclosed much information about the raids or the broader investigation and whether he is a target. But these raids do come amid several civil lawsuits that have been filed in recent weeks, accusing Combs and others within his inner circle of various crimes, including sex trafficking, sexual assault, and rape and domestic violence. The latest of these lawsuits was filed by producer Rodney Lil Rod Jones and was actually amended a few days ago to include actor Cuba Gooding Jr. as a defendant. Now, Jones is alleging that Diddy groped him repeatedly during the making of an album and also forced him to solicit sex workers to take illegal drugs, and that he was apparently also sexually harassed and assaulted by Gooding. The other lawsuits that have been filed against Combs include similar allegations, but Combs, as of at least right now, has not been criminally charged with any of the allegations. So, Rich, clearly a story that we're probably going to be covering in the coming weeks.
Yeah, and we all saw the video. I mean, it seemed like a lot of force. You know, I don't know that you needed this level of police involvement. On the other hand, who the hell am I? Who are we? Who's anyone to know, right? I mean, I support police taking whatever measures they need to within the law, within the grounds of reason to, you know, conduct an investigation. You never know when you go into these situations, whether there's going to be others or guns. And, you know, there is some gun investigation here. So if they are going a little bit overboard, then that's perfectly acceptable in my mind, given the seriousness of the allegations. And then, you know, more people are coming out of the woodwork and alleging that they have been the victims of Diddy over the years of, you know, various sexual assault and harassment cases. So more to come for sure. You know, this is sort of similar to the, you know, R. Kelly story that we've covered extensively over the years, and that resulted in, you know, that musician being in jail for probably the rest of his life. So, Jason, do you think it was too much, or the right amount here? And what's your take on this?
I mean, no one here on this call or anyone wants to be on the wrong side of this, right? I mean, that you say it's too much and it turns out that all these allegations are true and it was necessary to protect these people in order to use that much force. But you have to wonder where we are when every act to try to get evidence is considered too much and is publicized so hard. And how are these organizations going to conduct these investigations in the future if we do deem in the court of public opinion that these actions are too aggressive? I think it's hard not to watch those videos and go, is this because P. Diddy's black? Is it because he's a rapper? Is it because of these things, these systemic things? It does bring a lot of questions up. And I think it's appropriate to bring a lot of questions up. But that being said, protecting these people and finding evidence should be everyone's first priority. And I think from everything I've read and seen, it looks like they're conducting this with some level of what's appropriate versus versus what's being put onto the table?
I think you raised some great questions. I think Jordan is perfectly acceptable to question the police here and whether they acted this way or acting this way because he's black, because he's high profile. The high profile part is appropriate. I mean, listen, when high profile people like Donald Trump, like some of the people we're talking about, do bad things, then it's, in my opinion, the government's job to make an example of them. That certainly doesn't apply if he's black. And I think that's a valid question. We've seen examples of other people who have been accused and arrested for far worse things, being, you know, escorted out very nicely by the police and, you know, offered lunch. I mean, there's the there's that shooter up in the parade. Remember that guy? I want to forget his name now, from Antioch. But, you know, he was offered burger lunch before he was taken to the police station. That's a white guy. Right. So I think that's a really valid point that Jason brings up.
Yeah, that's all very true. The real head scratcher for me is that I believe that these raids were conducted by Homeland Security agents. And if that's the case, I'm just wondering if these raids were conducted based on activities that are already alleged or already part of sort of the public discourse, or if they're related to activities that we don't know anything about yet. So that's going to be something that will be revealed to us in the coming months.
There is a TikToker who's been spreading some interesting information to illegal immigrants. And that is how you can find a place to live and not have to worry about paying for it all.
Yeah, we covered this briefly with the assemblyman earlier, but unbelievable story. I mean, there's a TikToker with 500,000 followers, Tina, who is online offering his friends, his followers, tips on how to invade, in his words, unoccupied homes. He says that this is something that they need to do. If there's a house that's inhabited, we can seize it. He's cognizant, apparently, of the very lax laws that there are in Columbus, where he is, and many other states, including New York, where we've just covered, that allow squatters with maybe only 30 days notice, you know, the right to move in and occupy these homes for a long time. You know, this is a very disturbing video, right? It comes along with the heel. It comes on the heels of many other videos we've seen recently. And again, we touched on this story with the assemblyman, this trend apparently on the streets of New York of, you know, men punching women in the face. We also have seen a number of high profile murders, unfortunately, in the last couple of weeks. One of which was allegedly caused by a migrant from Venezuela. So, you know, this is not good. It certainly feeds the argument of many who are arguing that our migration system is broken. I think everyone concedes that. But yeah, pretty disturbing stuff, Tina.
I agree, Rich. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of facets to this, including what you just profiled, but also, you know, the continued discussion about whether or not TikTok should be prohibited here and all of the issues surrounding that. And we've covered this a lot on Legal Faceoff, putting aside the migrant crisis, which we've covered and covered today and will continue to cover. You know, this also just highlights some of the issues with people abusing social media platforms and various technologies to you know, try to facilitate, encourage criminal activity. And so I think this is just part of our continuing dialogue, Rich, about the need for these platforms to continue to evolve with how the usage of their platforms is evolving, to try to make sure that they are not somehow, you know, unintentionally facilitating the commission of a crime and other activities that they may not really want to be associated with.
Yeah, I think it's a great point. I mean, Jordan, you can't consider this story without considering the pending legislation to either outright ban TikTok or make it so that its Chinese owner sell to a U.S. owner. And I think Tina's right. I mean, this is a, you know, this should be exhibit A to the legislation of why TikTok should be better regulated. I mean, this is a guy who's here illegally and who's calling for millions of people to commit crimes against Americans.
Yeah, you know, it's really problematic to have people trying to persuade other people to commit crimes. And I think that people really need to look at issues with squatters in a lot of states across the country. You know, I listened to a podcast recently about squatters in Beverly Hills. And, you know, people can just basically break into a house and forge a lease, and then the police won't do anything. And then it becomes very expensive to get squatters ejected from residences. So there's that angle of people shouldn't be advocating for illegal behavior. And then there also should be some reflection on how the laws are a little bit too liberal when it comes to squatters' rights and how they should be tightened, perhaps.
Yeah, and it's just, Jason, I think that's all well stated. And Jason, this is just sort of like red meat for those. And let's face it, this is one of Trump's main election themes. He calls migrants vermin, right? He says they're animals. He says they're not human. And when you see a video of a guy like this who is, you know, very, very nasty looking, saying very nasty things in a foreign language, that plays into the basest emotions of people when they deal with this migrant issue and they see this video of someone yelling to take over homes. I mean, what could be more sort of, you know, what could feed into this notion that we're being attacked by?
Yeah, but to me, this is all Trumpian because he's talking about taking advantage of legal loopholes in squatter rights, right? And sticking it to people in a class system where these people feel oppressed and feel like they don't have homes and feel, and it could be interpreted as radical protest, right? And these loopholes exist, and all he's doing is exploiting these loopholes. Well, I think exactly everything that you guys said on this conversation is accurate. We have to look at these laws and make them more favorable at the same time of asking, why are there so many homes where people could just come in and take them over and make them their own in this country when there's so many people without homes? I think this is a very interesting social conversation from a legal standpoint. You know, just looking at it, it's like, okay, so there's these loopholes. Someone's saying take advantage of them. I remember when I was a kid, there was a guy in the suit with all the question marks. Get grants from the government today. It was all about taking advantage of loopholes, right? And I see this as a very angry loophole, but one that's there and someone saying, hey, exploit this if it's beneficial to you. And, you know, 7 people did this out of the 500,000 people that he has. So it's less than 1%. So I do feel a little bit like it's, a conversation that maybe if everyone was having would be a problem, but also this is just a little bit of, like you said, bringing into focus TikTok, bringing into focus the migrant issue. It's probably going to be overblown by everyone and every side of this issue. And it, from a legal standpoint, from being a homeowner myself, like looking at squatters' rights and how to fix those in this country is probably something that we should do that I think is nonpartisan, right? It affects everyone unsuccessfully, right? So that's kind of where I stand on it. Again, I'm from San Francisco, so I'm always going to take the most liberal approach to these topics.
Our next item, Hermes, the luxury fashion brand. If you want to get one of their Birkin bags, you have to have a history of regularly shopping at Hermes. And some folks who want a Birkin bag say, that's not fair. Is it, Christina?
So, yes, apparently that is the big million-dollar question. Hermes is facing a lawsuit over what the plaintiffs allege to be barriers to purchase the Birkin handbags. So a proposed class action was filed in California federal court this week alleging that Hermes is violating antitrust laws by requiring consumers to have what has been phrased a sufficient purchase history of buying other Hermes products such as shoes, scarves, and jewelry. And that these other purchases help them secure an opportunity to buy a Birkin handbag, which can go for hundreds of thousands of dollars. Plaintiffs claim that this alleged tying of the ability to even be in the running to buy one of the Birkin bags by purchasing these other ancillary products violates antitrust laws, and that sales associates actually allegedly screen consumers to pick out from the ones who are interested in purchasing a bag, whether they are qualified to purchase a handbag. The alleged criteria include sufficient purchase history. And apparently the compensation structure in which the sales associates are paid is by the hour with a commission on their sales, but apparently they don't get a cut of sales on the Birkin bags. One of the plaintiffs claims that she actually spent tens of thousands of dollars back in 2022 in order to obtain access to purchasing a Birkin bag. And she had actually contacted Hermes about a year ago about purchasing the bag, but was told that the bags were going to clients who have been consistent in supporting their business. The other plaintiff claims he was never even given the opportunity to buy a bag in the first place. The proposed class seeks to represent consumers who purchased or were asked to purchase these ancillary products. And the alleged violations include a violation of Section 2 of the Sherman Act, which prohibits acquiring or maintaining a monopoly through anti-competitive means, as well as the Cartwright Act, which is a California-specific antitrust law that bars certain restrictions on commerce and attempts to prevent competition and unfair competition. So, Rich, Birkin, the Birkin bag we had talked about earlier a few months ago in the context of that very famous IP case. And obviously Hermes won that, but this is an interesting one. And it's interesting because there are some legal theorists who claim that they think that Hermes is a pretty strong case. But obviously, as with all cases, this turns on the specific facts and whether the plaintiffs, as they claim the facts are in terms of their experiences with the sales associates, as you and I know, sometimes the truth is somewhere in the middle. And those are going to be pretty important in this case.
Yeah, I mean, this has become, these bags have become, it's incredible. And, you know, of course, as they become more valuable and exclusive, they generate more litigation stuff for us to talk about. I mean, Jordan, I was in New York last week and I saw a beautiful Birkin bag. This guy he assured me it was genuine. He did a great sales job and it was only like $29. $29. I mean, it seemed legit. No? Am I violating the Sherman Act?
Yeah, I mean, listen, that might be some Lanham Act or trademark issues. But, you know, to me, it does seem a little anti-competitive that Birkin is trying to loft its brand in the marketplace and exclude customers based on, you know, loyalty to them. But yeah, I mean, I agree, Tina. I think it all is really fact dependent, as it always is with these anti-competitive you know, cases. And I'm sure they talked with lawyers before they institute this policy, or I hope they would. So it's going to be interesting to see both sides of the story and to see if a fact finder ends up determining that there is anti-competitive behavior here.
Jason, do you own a Birkin?
Yeah, my girlfriend is a fashion designer, and we were talking about these bags in this case. And they were designed to be bags that people could access. They were not really designed to be what they've become. But you know, the rich people face discrimination. It's kind of a boohoo story, right? But at the same time, it sounds like they pissed off a lawyer who put something together. So maybe you should do better qualification if you're going to have this policy, is all I can say. And see if these people can actually cause harm to your brand. I don't think this overall looks good for their brand. I think people rather see just their bags become more expensive if it's really going to be something like that. Like, hey, if $100,000 isn't enough to get one of these things, maybe it needs to be, you know, $150,000, whatever that actually means, so that people can have access to it.
Lee Greenwood's song, God Bless the USA, has become the theme for something being offered for sale by former President Donald Trump. God Bless the USA Bibles at $59.99 a pop. And he's got a reason for selling them, doesn't he, Rich?
Well, he says it's his favorite book, right? We all know that Trump's favorite book has always been the Bible, right? I mean, who could not think of Donald Trump and not thinking of Deuteronomy or, you know, Genesis? I mean, it just goes hand in hand, literally. We all remember when he held up the Bible outside the church, right? And he did so
upside down.
Upside down. What better way to tell the general public that you're in love with the good book than by holding it upside down and in your photo op? But yeah, you know, listen, after the sneakers, after the, what was it? $400 sneakers, Tina, the gold sneakers that immediately sold out. He's looking to raise money. I mean, listen, yesterday, the Dems, Biden had that record setting fundraiser with Obama and Clinton and Biden all appearing together. I think Queen Latifah was there, a couple others. I think they raised $25 million in one night. So Trump's got to catch up. On the other hand, by all accounts, he made out, what did he make, $1 billion on the Truth Social coin? I mean, that stock went crazy the other day. So fun continue. Are you going to buy one of these Bibles, Tina? You love this.
Yeah.
You love the good as much as anyone.
I love the good word just like everybody else. I just find it a little bit, I don't know, suspect that it's not just the Bible, Rich. It's Lee Greenwood lyrics. It's, you know, the Constitution. It's the Bill of Rights. It's like there are many addendums to the good word that is being sold for this, you know, really this bargain basement price of like $59.99.
Hey, Jason, remind me of what part of the Bible talked about paying off strippers.
I mean, a lot of it does. If you've ever taken a look. No, I think it's just great that God, that Trump's trying to make God great again. So I appreciate that. And I'm looking forward to cracking that book open.
Jordan, on steal. The of Good Friday or Passover.
Yeah, you know, I mean, look, they tried Trump steaks and now it's Trump Bibles. I don't think I'd buy one. I would buy the shoes, but I don't think he makes my size. I'm a size 16, so I think I'm going to be out of luck for that.
All right, we'll end off. We didn't have time for our one story involving Mike Lindell, the MyPillow guy, who's also hurting for money, but it prompted me to ask this question. We like to end off every grab bag with a little segment, go around the horn and learn a little bit about our guests, including our new best friend, Dave. Mike Lindell, of course, is famous for MyPillow, selling stuff that we could all get on TV by calling an 800 number. What's the one thing in your life that you've purchased from an infomercial? Anything that you looked at that commercial and thought, I have to have this? Dave, anything on your end? What's the last time you bought something based on an infomercial? Ethan, what do you got?
Well, my grandma buys all of her presents for her granddaughter from QVC, which I'm guessing is a similar thing. And the only thing that I've ever bought from a 1-800 number is I think I bought like a when I was like 19, a full collection of Beatles, like when they were releasing one or something and they had like a TV thing. And one time the Beastie Boys did a infomercial that showed on up at midnight and I bought something from that. So far I'm doing good. I'm not buying my pillows. I prefer to go to a store still.
Jordan, operators are standing by. Have you ever responded to those?
It's incredible.
Wait, there's more.
No, it's incredible because I also bought the Beatles one CD. So that impacted all of us. So yeah, no, I had that CD and I enjoyed it, and I probably still have it somewhere.
I bought a ton, but Tina, what do you got? Anything that you remember buying?
Yeah, so you know, back in the day before the internet, so I feel like I'm dating myself with that as a preface to what I'm going to say. You know, we used to see in the middle of the night, like those infomercials about like those music collections, like KTEL, for example. And there were a number of different purveyors, if you will, of these collections. And so we bought one. And what they neglected to say was that this was not the original version by the band that made it popular. So it was a cover that kind of sort of sounded like it, but they didn't say, you know, John and the Dorkwads who were recording, you know, a version of the song rather than the actual artist that made it famous. So, yeah, felt like I had gotten cheated out of my money's worth.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've been victimized by a number of infomercials over the years. I mean, again, before the internet, you would be watching cartoons or Happy Days and these infomercials would come on and be like, wow, for only $29.99, I could get two of them. And then you pay for shipping and handling and, you know, takes 8 weeks and you're waiting. But for me, it all begins and ends with Columbia House, Tina. I mean, who among us didn't build their record collection by Columbia House? The pitch, Jordan, Jason, and Dave, you remember this, was 11 records for the low price of a penny. And I can remember when you would actually tape a penny to the thing and mail it in. That was their whole sales pitch. And then, by the way, before we were lawyers, we didn't know to read the small print. The small print said, you're now committed for the rest of your life to Columbia House Corporation for a monthly record that costs like, you know, $90. You know, instead of like paying 10 bucks for the Thriller CD, you are now committed to the Columbia House jacked up price. So it was all Ponzi scheme, but I got them back. I would, like many people in my era, you would keep re-upping under different names. So you would have different pseudonyms that you would send in and then try to cancel. But canceling the Columbia House contract is perhaps the hardest uphill battle of all time, Tina. So out there somewhere is about 10 or 11 versions of me still owing Columbia House hundreds and hundreds of dollars.
That wraps up this edition of Legal Face-Off's Legal Grab Bag. Our guests, Jordan Rothman of Rothman Law, LLC, and Jason Reichel of TrustLayer.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab, so hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget...